Charles Glass, whom is a longtime Oregon activist and I've known for a real long time. Charles Gray. Charles Gray and Joseph Schneider, thank you, and then Rob Weissman from the Multinational Monitor. And Joe Schneider is also a local Portland activist working on MIA and other free trade agreements, Portland Fair Trade Coalition. So, without further ado.
I'm going to start off not talking directly about the free trade agreements, but giving a little background on the actual size of corporate power, because it's very related to why we have these free trade agreements. And then Joe and Rob are going to talk more specifically about the agreements themselves.
Can everyone hear?
Can you hear me?
No. A little louder.
Okay, I'll speak a little louder.
Because the mics are not amplification.
Not for the room. I am challenging the conventional analysis of corporate economic power that compares the revenues of corporations with the gross domestic product of nations. That analysis finds that of the 100 largest economic entities in the world, 51 of them are corporations. Such an analysis was done by Sarah Anderson and John Kavanaugh of the Institute for Policy Studies. You may have seen references to it in David Corton's book, When Corporations Rule the World, or in the New Internationalist magazine, or in the literature of the Alliance for Democracy. Such a comparison has some uses, but it is quite useless, in my view, for comparing the economic power of corporations and nations. It exaggerates the power of nations, and contrary to its presumed goal, it minimizes the power of corporations. That doesn't help our cause any. In the Anderson-Kavanaugh study, there were 21 nations above the two richest corporations. As a measure of economic power, comparing corporate revenues with GDP, that's gross domestic product, of nations is invalid for the simple reason that most wealth represented by gross domestic product is in private or corporate hands, not in the hands of government or any single decision-making body, and thus is not available as a counter to corporate power. If instead we compare government budgets with corporate revenues, or government revenues, it's been close most of the time, we uncover the shocking fact that of the world's 100 largest economic entities, 66 are corporations, and only 34 are nations. Only 7 governments outrank the richest corporations, not 22, as in the Anderson treatment. That's a big difference, as we shall see. The giant corporations have greater economic power than all but a few of the nations of the world. Each of the top three, ExxonMobil, General Motors, and Ford, has more annual revenue than all but 7 of the 191 nations of the world. The top 6 companies, ExxonMobil, General Motors, Ford, Mitsui, Daimler, Chrysler, and Mitsubishi, together have more annual revenues than any nation except the United States. More revenues, these 6 corporations, that's a tiny number of corporations, of course, more than the combined budgets of 64 nations containing 58% of the population of the world. These nations include India, Indonesia, Brazil, Russia, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Nigeria, Mexico, and 56 others. The revenues of the top 14 corporate giants taken together surpass the revenues of the United States government. In the old days, there was a common saying that 14 families ran El Salvador. And those of us who were involved in Central America work may remember statements like that. Might not be far from the truth to say that the world's top 14 companies together are economically more powerful than the United States government. Though some of these corporations are in competition with each other, they share a common ideology, and many have common interests. For example, of the top 7 corporations in revenue in the world, of the top 7, 5 are in the auto or oil industries. should we wonder why efforts to reduce greenhouse gases are stalled in spite of the global warming crisis? The auto and oil interests are behind the stalling. Should we wonder why the $200 billion highway transportation bill breezed through the last Congress? The auto and oil industries love highways. I've actually analyzed all the corporations of the Fortune 500. Now it's just 490 because of mergers just in 1 year. To qualify as one of the 490, a corporation had to have $9 billion in annual revenue. I also analyzed the 191 nations of the world, 57 of which had budgets of $9 billion or more. Remember that I said with this analysis, it turns out that of the top 100 economic entities, 66 are corporations. Wow. That says something about power. But wait, it gets worse. Of the top 200, 161 are corporations. That's 80%. Of the total sample of 547 corporations or national governments, 490 are corporations. That's 90% of the entities. Only 57 governments are even in the same ballpark as the Fortune 500. And any of the Fortune 500 outrank 134 of the governments of the world. Admittedly, some of these governments are in nations with small populations, but some of them are large. Bangladesh, population 128 million. Vietnam, population 76 million. Ethiopia, population 58 million. Congo, population 49 million. Together, these 134 nations make up almost a fifth of the population of the world. None of them has as much economic power as even the poorest of the Fortune 500. We can talk about poor, a $9 billion corporation. 85% of these corporations are headquartered in just five nations, which contain only 10% of the world's people, the US, Japan, Germany, France, and the United Kingdom. Total revenue of the 490 corporations is $11.5 trillion out of a GNP in my purchasing power equivalent dollars of around $32 trillion. These 490 corporations produce $11.5 trillion in gross product, $4 trillion more than the 191 governments of the world. So in summary, the 490 corporations are more powerful than governments in both the numbers of them at the top and in the total revenues they generate. Now let's compare the revenue of corporations with the income of the world's population. For per capita income figures, I'm using purchasing power parity dollars that adjust for differences in cost of living from one country to another. So you may see different estimates on some of these income things. It depends on what kind of a dollar you're using. This data also uses the distribution of income within each country and not just national averages, which lump the rich and the poor together. Unfortunately, the data is 9 years old for this income data. I believe, however, that only the richest 20% or 25% of the people of the world have benefited at all from the growth in the past decade or so. Consequently, I think this data gives a fairly good estimate of the incomes of the people of the world below the 75th or 80th percentile today. I'll be happy to explain my reasons for thinking this in the question period if someone is interested. Now, what do I find? I find that just the top five corporations combined have more revenues than the total income of 20% of the people of the world, just five companies. That's 1.17 billion people. Now, hear this. The revenues of the Fortune 500 corporations exceed the income of 75% of the world's people. Can you believe that? The revenues of the Fortune 500 corporations exceed the income of 75% of the people of the world. Wow. This is a tiny minority of the world's enterprises, of course, employing less than 2% of the world's labor force. And they have more than the income of 4.4 billion people, making up 75% of the people of the world. The reason this is so, of course, is because the majority of the 75% of the world's people are crushed in the poverty of unemployment, underemployment, and cheap labor. Over a billion people have per capita incomes averaging about $1.72 a day, or $2.50 a working day. If they had the luxury of an 8-hour day, that figure would be about 31 cents an hour. In the global sweatshops, of course, many work 10 days and 6 days a week, sometimes even seven. The average for the middle fifth of humanity, I'm not talking about the poor now, but the world's middle class in reality, the middle fifth of humanity is about $1.42 an hour. The average for the blue-collar employee of the 365 largest corporations in the United States in 1998 was $12.65 an hour, about nine times that of the middle fifth of humanity. However, the CEO of his or her company had a compensation package of $10.6 million for 1 year, or $5,300 an hour, or 419 times as much as the blue-collar worker in his plant. I think last night our speaker said 429, so we must have read different reports on this. But anyway, it's enormous. 2 years ago, the ratio was about 209-1. That's an increase of over 100% in 2 years. The CEO compensation thing is just exponentially going out of sight. Would that workers got such a raise. 33 years ago, that ratio was around 44-1. So it's really some phenomenon. I won't continue this tragic story of maldistribution much further, except to say that the Forbes 400 richest Americans had an average increase in assets in 1996 of $365 million, $1 million for each day in the year. At the top end of this madness, and it is truly a brutal and murderous madness, with millions of human beings dying of starvation each year, is Bill Gates, of course, who between early this month, there's a Bill Gates wealth clock website. You can check it, because every day he goes up or down to 3 billion in assets. So I checked it from early this month back to early May a year ago. His assets increased in this 1 year, $38.2 billion. That's just the increase, not his net worth. A gain greater than the national budgets of any of 160 of the 191 governments of the world. The gain is a 75% increase over his average gain for the previous 2 years. Knowing that he is a workaholic, that's his reputation at least, I guess that he might work 10 hours a day, 6 days a week. Well, you've got to work a long time to make that kind of money, you know? And if so, that would compute to $127 million a day. And for a 10-hour day, that would mean $12.7 million per working hour. He's building a $50 or $60 million mansion up there on Puget Sound, and he'd pay for that in a half a day. Most of us spend all our lives paying off our mortgage. This explosive concentration of money at the top is another part of the picture of corporate power and globalization. What does this ascendant corporate power mean for democracy? How can we have a democratic society when shiploads of money are available to corrupt the political process by elections, by laws, by trade treaties favorable to the corporate agenda? In addition, corporations by their very nature are undemocratic. They are hierarchical, secretive, and the voting power of the minority of the population that owns stock is based not on one person, one vote, but on the shares of stock owned. So money rules. If you have 5 shares of stock, you have 5 votes. If I have 50,000 shares of stock, I have 50,000 votes. Real democratic, right? Sounds good to me. In recent years, corporations have become global, and they are demanding successfully that governments get out of their way with deregulation, privatization, and the reduction of national sovereignty in the economic arena. That is what the trade treaties are about. And for the details of how these treaties are used to advance the corporate agenda, I'll soon turn over the podium to my partners here, Joe Snyder and Rob Weissman. I'll leave you with a hopeful thought. All is not yet lost. We are not powerless. Ultimately, the giants depend on us. Our high consumption is their lifeblood. Our support of the militarism that protects their ill-gotten gains allows them to thrive. They continue their socially environmental and environmentally destructive path only as long as we continue buying. They continue their global conquest of the world's wealth only as long as we continue buying. That's all I'm going to say. I have some handouts, and I want to describe them to you just very briefly. This sheet here, maybe at the end, I'll leave them up here in a, and I may take some off back there. This sheet here shows that six corporations that are more powerful than the 64 nations have more revenues than the government, the budgets of 64 nations a year. That's shown in this graphic, and it's to scale. This one is about the income distributions I talked about in the world between the poor and the rich, including Bill Gates. This one here is like this color poster. Well, I'll hold this one up here. I put this research into a form that people might be able to use in their educational work. It's called Corporate Cash, Few Nations Can Top It. It shows the few that are on top, and most of the squares are, the squares are all corporations, the circles are nations, and it's got a lot of commentary similar to what I've been talking about. If you're interested, I'm selling it. I'll be around the halls with that thing around my neck.
Have you incorporated?
I haven't incorporated. But I may soon if it's popular. But there's a black and white version of this poster that's free for the asking, and it's here on the table also. It's exactly the same material. Thank you very much.
While these corporations, are, as you can see, are enormously wealthy and powerful, and at this present moment, and last night Ronnie Duger spoke briefly about how they got that way, it doesn't appear to be enough, as far as they're concerned, which may be a good sign, which may mean that we're still capable, and that they're grasping for more power may mean that we're still capable of resisting them. And the present state of affairs is not corporate nirvana. Ronnie Duger spoke about how previously, before 1886, corporations had charters that were limited by time and in what they could do. The legislatures could, of individual states or the nation, could regulate them without the need for due process. But after they achieved personhood in 1886, they became sort of a superhuman being who can live forever and accumulate wealth and isn't really accountable. And has become less accountable. However, although as powerful as they have been as superpersons in the United States, the struggle of people in the United States and around the world has managed to cut into their profit margins by forcing labor laws, environmental laws, workplace health and safety laws. These have all pinched down on the profit margins of corporations. Also, perhaps, the fact that we are all slackers reduces the profit margin. A little bit of slacking off at work can reduce the rate of exploitation. Also, I don't want to advocate theft, but that happens in the workplace, and that also reduces the rate of exploitation. So perhaps we've all been a little bit, if not on strike, on slowdown or work at a rule for the past 25 years, because the productivity rate has been flat since then. So one of the ways that the corporations have sought to get around these things is to get around these, what few controls we have on them anymore is through these multinational trade treaties. The nation state and the subnational governments are the entities that have been putting, that we have been using, because they're still, depending on how democratic they are, contested ground that we can use to put restraints on them. And they're not very happy about that. So they've gone to use these multilateral trade agreements to circumvent the power of the state and get themselves new rights and force new obligations towards them by the state. Now let's get specific about this. The multilateral agreement on investment sort of follows NAFTA. And we'll talk a little bit about NAFTA, because they're very similar. NAFTA prefigures a lot in the MAI, but the MAI is more radical in its provisions, and also because it's not supposed to include just three countries, as NAFTA does currently, but the whole world, they envision. This has been negotiated at the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development since 1995, mostly in secret. A draft text of the treaty was leaked to the press in 1997, previous to that, the Clinton administration denied that there was a draft treaty. But it's now on the Public Citizen website. You can all look at it if you want. Since that time, it has been set back a bit because of citizen pressure. Once again, a victory for us. France withdrew from the talks in October at the OECD, and that effectively put an end to it there.
Also, the defeat of Fast Track Trading Authority for President Clinton last spring was a great victory for this. Fast Track Trading Authority allows negotiations to go on in secret, and the Congress is given by the Constitution exclusive rights over international trade, international commerce, but the Fast Track is one way that they delegate the authority to the executive branch so they can negotiate treaties. But it also includes an abrogation of the right of the legislature to amend these treaties. Lots of folks wanted to put amendments on NAFTA when it was being debated to improve environmental and safety and labor, but you couldn't because the President Clinton had Fast Track Trading Authority when he negotiated it, so it could not be amended. Also, you have limited time for debate, so you can't get this all these activists involved because it'll be forced through too quickly. It limits debate to a matter of weeks once the treaty is presented to the Congress, so in a straight up or down vote. And by calling it an agreement, not a treaty, it avoids that whole nasty two-thirds requirement that the Constitution puts on treaties. You can just have a bare majority vote, which is nice. Some of the specific provisions of the MAI are that I find most objectionable and that we should most be concerned about is all signatory nations to the treaty must be given national treatment and most favored nation status. Most favored nation is the best trading deal that we give any other country. So that, and these cannot be changed because of the environmental or human rights records of these nations. So you got to treat Burma just the way you treat Canada. You got to treat China just the same way you treat Britain. So there can be no discrimination amongst the nations that sign this treaty. So no more Burma laws, no more pressure like we put on South Africa using trade laws. Not just at the national level, but because if this treaty passes, it'll be national law. It will have precedence over local and state laws. And so they will have to conform to this as well. Perhaps the most worrisome, some of you who are environmental activists are familiar with the takings movement in the United States, which wanted to change expropriation laws. The state can come and expropriate your property. They did when they put this freeway through the city, and they came and eminent domain people's houses, took it away from them, gave them some money, they had to compensate them, and then put the freeway through. Previously, you had to take the property in its entirety, all economic value of it. The state had to, the governmental entity had to take all of it in order to, for the person who was expropriated to be liable, for that to be an expropriation. To be given its compensation for. The language in the MAI means that any effective reduction in the value of an investment would require compensation, which means that any action taken by a government which has the effect of reducing the value of an investment would require compensation to the investor. So, for instance, if we manage to pass some sort of clear-cutting ban in Oregon someday, and there's a foreign company. Now, foreign corporations are the only ones, foreign investors are the only ones who can take advantage of the MAI. It's foreign corporations use it to, are covered by it, one abroad. Domestic corporations, domestic investors can't use it. So GM has a plant here in Oregon, and the MAI would not cover that. If Mitsubishi does, they could use the provisions of the MAI. So if a forest company that was owned by foreign investors had some land that they were planning to clear cut and would pass the clear cutting ban, that would reduce the value of their investment. They could then go to the state of Oregon and say, by passing this ban on clear cutting, you cost the value of our investment went down. You owe us for all the lost value of our investment plus any potential lost profits. This sounds a little far-fetched, but it's already happened because there are provisions similar to this in the North American Free Trade Agreement. I have the case of Ethel Corporation, Ethel Corporation is based in Richmond, Virginia, and they make a gasoline additive called MMT, which is manganese-based, and it's a lead substitute. The United States didn't allow it for use in our gasoline after lead was banned as a lead substitute, but Canada did allow MMT. Recently, Canada found that it was damaging catalytic converters in automobiles and thus increasing pollution, so they banned MMT. Under similar provisions to the expropriation provision in the MAI, Ethel Corporation sued the government of Canada for $290 million, saying, you have effectively expropriated the value of our Sarnia, Ontario plant where we make this stuff. And we also want money for the potential lost profits we have from selling MMT in Canada. And we want some money because you damaged our good name. So this went before an arbitration panel, an NAFTA arbitration panel, which can operate in secret at the option of the sewer, the investor, that is. And Ethel won the first round, and it looked like they were going to continue to win. So the government of Canada backed off and unbanned MMT. So it's a concrete example of how this is used to take away the capacity of governments to legislate to protect the health and of their citizens. What is this stuff I'm talking about investors suing governments? Now, that's new in and of itself, and it was new to NAFTA, and it's included in the MAI. It gives the foreign investors, mind you, not domestic investors, the MAI says you must treat foreign investors as well as you treat domestic investors in your country, but it doesn't say you can't treat them better. If a law does not conform to the provisions of the MAI, a foreign investor, and a foreign investor has been harmed by, say, one of these effective expropriations, like a clear-cutting ban or a change in zoning laws, they can sue the government that took this action, government body, whether it be local, state, or federal, for compensation, either in their own courts or at various international arbitration panels. These include the United Nations Commission on International Trade Law, the World Bank's International Center for Investment Disputes, and this is my favorite, the International Chamber of Commerce International Court of Arbitration. So they could haul Oregon up before the International Chamber of Commerce Court of Arbitration to try to get a judgment. A fair body, if there ever was. Also worrisome to local governments is performance requirements are conditions that governments place on for the receipt of government contracts or subsidies. We have a number of them here in Portland. We have a living wage law that says that any company which contracts with the city of Portland has to pay its workers a living wage, which is above the minimum wage, and give them health benefits. That's a condition, and so that's a performance requirement. NAFTA allows performance requirements for environmental and health and safety reasons. The MAI bans them entirely. You cannot have any performance requirements. Things like other examples include community reinvestment requirements for subsidies for banks. This would take away a lot of the power, a lot of the means that local governments use to regulate their health and safety in the locality. So Portland's living wage law would be overturned by the MAI, as would, we also have the Sustainable Portland Program, which requires those institutions which contract with the state, with the city to recycle, to use environmental safe practices. So conditions like these, which might be placed on contracts which favor the environmentally responsible, those who have responsible labor practices, would be overturned. So that's another tool that we have been able to use to force more humane practices upon corporations to be taken out of their hands. Now, the MAI, once it's taken into effect, it would be, one of the things that happens when you pass these trade laws is you pass the law itself, and then there's implementing legislation, which harmonizes national laws with the new treaty, so there's no conflict. And the MAI says that there can be no new non-conforming laws after the MAI is passed, so nothing that would contradict these provisions would be allowed. That's known as, in the language of the text, standstill. Also, any laws that are already on the books when it's passed have to be taken off the books. that don't conform to the MAI, anything that conflicts with it, such as living wage law here in Portland, or any other performance requirement. That is referred to as rollback in the language of the text. Also, certain exceptions can be written into the treaty that would allow certain non-conforming laws to stand for a while, but that is of a limited time. They are all expected to be rolled back eventually. That is only temporary. Together, in the language of the text, standstill and rollback create a, quote, ratchet effect that will, and this is quoting effect, that will lock in investor rights so they could not be rescinded or nullified over time. So that's how democracy works for you with the corporation. You also saw the same language when NAFTA was being passed, is that we're going to lock the Mexicans into these policies. What if the Mexicans don't want these policies? And that's sort of what the Democrat, a Democrat with a small D would ask. Perhaps the people of that nation don't want the policies anymore. No, we're going to lock them in because they're beneficial to the corporations, the international investors. The international investing nations are the United States, Western Europe, the nations of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, that is, say, the 29 largest corporations that are also the home for 487 of the Fortune 500 companies. I don't know how many after the merger. I don't know how that affects that. So it's the big investor nations that are want to force this upon the rest of the world. What if we did a nation, Mexico or us, decide that we don't like these and we want out of the MAI? Well, after 5 years, the MAI must be in effect for 5 years so we get used to it. And then we can announce our intention to withdraw. However, even after you announce your intention to withdraw, a nation, the MAI stays in effect in that nation for 15 years after that. So if this gets passed, you live with it for 20 years. Maybe the United States could shake it off because we've got the largest market in the world and say, screw you, we're gonna abrogate the treaty anyway. And that would work, maybe. But Senegal can't do it. You know, they depend for preponderance of their income on cocoa. One cash crop. What are they going to do? They can't tell the world trade to go away. They're dependent on that income. So they're going to be forced by this mechanism, by their own debt, and their own dependence on cash crops sold on the world market to implement these things. That'll be the mechanism by which you force otherwise reluctant countries to sign on to this. Another worrisome aspect is it bans all controls on the movement of capital across borders. Right now, let's see, 25 years ago, all trade and currencies, 90% of it was for real investment. That is to say, people were buying foreign currency so they could then make a real investment in that country, perhaps buy a plant, buy some real estate, buy some machinery, hire some workers. And 10% was speculative. That is holding the currency, just hoping that the value of that currency goes up relative to, say, the dollar, and instead of selling it. Today, that's reversed. 90% of all currency trading is speculative, and 10% is for real investment. It's just another thing to trade in the casino of Wall Street, is currency. However, it has real effects on nations. The Mexican economic meltdown of 94, which spread to the rest of Latin America in the tequila effect, was begun by a rapid, sudden disinvestment from Mexico, people pulling their investment out of Mexico, and a crash in the peso. That was also the opening of the Asia crisis that began last year, when the Thai currency crashed and the Indonesian currency. This would make the whole world economy more volatile because controls on the movement of capital flows prevent these sort of things from happening. Chile has them. They're called speed bumps. If you're going to buy an investment in Chile, this would require you to keep it for 6 months. So that prevents a lot of the speculative movement of capital, slows it down, and makes you less vulnerable to sudden, rapid disinvestment that can cause your economy to crash. So the economy will become more volatile as well under the MAI. Maybe that's a good thing, maybe, but no, it's not, because of the misery that's going to be caused by that. That's all. Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. but the nations of the OECD, Japan, and Western Europe are going to reintroduce the MAI at the World Trade Organization, who are conveniently meeting in Seattle in November.
What do you think the chances of the U.S. agreeing to
it? It's one of the main components of the MAI. I mean, U.S. multinational corporation, we should probably wait for the question. We're going to take questions in a little bit. But the U.S. is one of the didn't want to move it from the OECD because they thought they couldn't get as good a deal at the World Trade Organization as they could at the OECD. OECD is the 29 richest countries, so it's the rich man's club. And they offered pretty much maybe get an agreement there that they would like. However, the World Trade Organization, there's going to be people like Malaysia and India in the room, and you know maybe they're not going to be able to get everything they want with the World Trade Organization. So the U.S. didn't want to move it there because they wanted a really strong MAI. So maybe it's a good thing, it's a victory for us, but the thing isn't entirely dead. Here in Portland, at the Portland Fair Trade Coalition, we're trying to get the city council to pass a resolution declaring Portland an MAI-free zone, which San Francisco did last year, and Seattle, the host of the World Trade Organization, did on April 12th. So welcome to Seattle, don't do this.
So did King County and Snohomish County.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Olympia.
Yeah, Olympia and Boulder and Berkeley. It's all in the West, I'm not sure why. And all the municipalities of British Columbia together in their organization. So the West, the Northwest in particular, is very much against this. Although, and we're hoping to get this passed. I've had people in David Wu's office, the congressman, U.S. congressman from District 1 in Oregon, say that he in particular would really take notice if we could get the an anti-MAI resolution passed. It would carry a lot of weight with him and the other congressional delegation. They would notice, noticing this sort of upswell of dissent, they would pay attention to that. So if y'all have the energy, make a phone call to your city council, if you will, and tell them that you oppose the MAI. Hope that they would go on record doing so. Thank you.
I want to talk to you about three things. The first is brief and is kind of how I can promote myself with you. The second is a little bit about the WTO, and the third is about something that's different. I want to try to take some of these examples of these trade agreements and talk about how a particular industry uses them and what the effect is on actual people, including sick people, which is the pharmaceutical industry, and how it affects people with HIV/AIDS. First, the self-promotion piece. I edit this magazine, Multinational Monitor. You hope they're all picking this up. There's some in the back. We're giving that for free. We'd like you to subscribe. You can subscribe for a discount on the back for this page, which is in the back there. I do a weekly column with a colleague named Russell Mokhiber called Focus on the Corporation. You can subscribe to that if you wish. There's no charge. Electronically, if you go to the webpage, www.corporatepredators.org. That's also the name of a book that Russell and I have done of our thing, which is on sale downstairs. And we have a cheat board if you don't want to buy it here but want to buy it later. So that's the promotional piece. I was going to skip the WTO, but I think because of the geographical opportunity that you all have in November, it would be worth discussing a little bit and how it fits in to the whole picture. But let me see. Do people know what the WTO is? Do you know what the acronym stands for? People are generally familiar with all this stuff. That's why you came to this group. Some, but not all, apparently. So the WTO is the World Trade Organization. It was founded 3 years ago, 4 years ago now. It came out of something called the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. Unfortunately, when we talk about all this trade stuff, you get this whole series of acronyms. And I don't think there's any way around it. So anyway, there's the GATT, which is the set of agreements, the World International Trade Agreements. And there's the WTO, which is the World Trade Organization, the actual entity that administers the trade agreements in the GATT. And there are a series of them, one of which I'll talk about in some detail. The WTO, or the GATT, which preceded the WTO, before there was no formal organization, was originally about administering tariffs between different countries. In other words, what were going to be the taxes on imported goods. And the general goal following its creation after World War II was to bring tariffs down. But that was basically what the agreement was about. In the 1980s, though, multinational corporations, primarily U.S. corporations, decided that there was an opportunity to use the language of trade to do a whole new set of things. And they started a new negotiating round, which is called the Uruguay Round, which led to the creation of the WTO ultimately almost a decade later. And in that, they started defining things that were not tariff-related as trade issues. So one of them, for example, was intellectual property, which is what I'm going to talk about more. Another was investment. They did a weak version of some of the MAI stuff. They also talked about services. Traditionally, trade had been in goods. They said, well, it should also include services, and we should be concerned about that as well. And they also, and probably the most brazen of the moves, decided that there are different kinds of trade barriers. There could be tariff trade barriers, where an imported good is taxed at, say, 100% rate, which might make it prohibitive as compared to domestically produced goods. But they also said there can be non-tariff trade barriers. Maybe countries are using things that are disguised trade barriers, things like, say, health and safety regulations or environmental regulations, which they say they're doing because they want to protect health or safety or the environment. Maybe it happened that environmental groups got those laws passed. Maybe consumer groups got the health and safety laws passed. But whatever, the real effect of them, and maybe the real purpose, was to discriminate against foreign-made imports, and therefore they should be leveled. Or at least they should have to be made to adhere to a very high level of scientific proof to ensure that they weren't disguised trade barriers, that they were really, in fact, legitimate, science-based health, safety, labor, workplace safety, environmental, other similar kinds of regulation. So what they did, and they created, and the they in this case is interesting. There's a couple of theys who did this. One they, the leading negotiator in this whole thing, was the United States. This was an agreement negotiated among countries. Most countries of the world are now members of the World Trade Organization. The United States drove the agenda as a government. But the U.S. operated as a government basically on behalf of multinational corporations, which is no exaggeration. It's not even really disputed in many cases. The U.S. trade negotiators said quite explicitly that they were trying to promote the interests of U.S. industry. And if you read stuff on their website, the trade representative's website, which is ustr.gov, you'll see it's pretty common. In fact, in the area when I'm going to talk about intellectual property, if you call them with a question, they can't easily answer. They refer you to the Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Trade Association, which makes sense because they actually plagiarize things that the trade association gives them, and they submit them to the WTO and other places. Anyway, they created a new kind of dispute settlement process, which is the mechanism by which disputes between countries are worked out. And in the old days, the GATT, prior to the new agreement, which was implemented in 1995, the GATT would make a ruling, and basically any country in the world had a veto power over that. So it was almost like a recommendation. But if countries didn't want to go along, they could kind of get out of it. They could sort of put their foot down and say, sorry, we're not going to do it. But with the World Trade Organization, that's been flipped upside down. The only way a ruling by one of the dispute settlement panels, which are these kind of arbitration panels that listen to disputes between countries, can be overturned is if every country decides that they want to overturn the decision, including the country that won. So that's unlikely. And there's a strong bias in the agreement, in the section on non-tariff trade barriers, against various kinds of environmental health and safety regulations. And in fact, it turns out that in every case that's been brought in the few years that the agreement has existed, the plaintiff country, the country that sues another country for an environmental regulation or a health and safety regulation, always wins. Always. There's no exception to that. So the United States actually doesn't always win. The United States loses when other countries are challenging our environmental standards. So you can figure out, again, which interests the U.S. government negotiators were representing when they negotiated the treaty. So just to give a few quick examples of some of the things that have taken place and how this plays out. One you might know about is this issue of the U.S. trying to export beef to Europe that's been treated with hormones. And maybe, I wasn't here last night, I don't know if Ronnie talked about that. The European Union says, we think this stuff isn't safe. We're not interested. You guys want to do your hormone thing, keep it in your country. We don't want to take it in. And the United States says, it's plenty safe. You're going to take it. And Europe says, no, we're powerful, we're not a third world government, we don't have to just bow to you, we do what we want. The United States says, no, you're not that powerful, we're going to the WTO, and the U.S. has won a decision that says Europe has to import the hormone-treated beef. Now, in fact, Europe is strong, and it's unclear still whether they're going to agree to follow the rules of the WTO. But poorer countries don't have that option. Just take one other example with the U.S. regulation. The United States has a variety of environmental regulations that are designed to protect species that are affected when there's harvesting of seafood. So a lot of you know about the tuna dolphin case, and there's also the shrimp turtle case, where the U.S. has a rule that says when shrimp are being, any shrimp that's being either sold United, that's going to be sold in the United States, imported or produced domestically, it has to be caught with specific kinds of devices that keep out turtles. So that in the course of catching the shrimp, you don't catch turtles and destroy turtles unintentionally. And a variety of countries, including Thailand, said, well, that's an unfair trade barrier against us. They brought a case against the United States, and they won. Because automatically, whoever's challenging the environmental rules wins at the WTO. And on down the line. There have been a handful of cases like this. There's going to be more. But what's probably even more significant than the cases that actually get decided is the just the very existence of the trade agreement and the trade organization enables industries and countries to challenge, to threaten other countries with...